Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
9 minutes past 6 o'clock. Rain for Bruce on The Money Show. And The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. The big story at the moment, the big developing news story, it starts at about 40 minutes ago. We got wind of it from Newsroom Africa breaking the story. Now it's all over. The big developing news story, news agencies reporting that former Steinhoff CEO Marcus Yerster has shot himself during his arrest. The Money Show, of course, bringing you full details on this in the next hour. We'll continue to bring you these details as they do emerge. This comes after the Financial Sector Conduct Authority issued a penalty of 475 million rand against him. That was the big story yesterday. In 2017, he was embroiled in an accounting scandal. Remember that? They called it an accounting scandal. It was more like fraud, which led to the collapse of the global retailer. I remember that day. I remember working in the Eyewitness newsroom, and we had a situation with what happened is Bruce came running to me saying, Ray, have you seen what's going on? And we could see this market price just tumbling, absolutely being destroyed and losing 200 billion rand in market value as it went down and went down. And of course, it all started out in Germany, and the German police had raided Steinhoff's offices there. And as soon as that story broke that they had been cooking the books, put it that way, then the market price, the share price just went down. And of course, this latest development. Well, joining us to discuss this is Rob Rose, who's the former editor of the Financial Mail and the author of Steinheist. Hi, Rob. Good evening. Good to have you on The Money Show.
Thanks.
Right, Rob, what have you heard? Because we have little bits of information. What have you heard?
Ray, well, pretty much what you heard. I was alerted by Newsroom Africa to the story, and I've spoken to various people who are themselves trying to confirm it, but not at the scene, obviously. So we haven't done that. It was alarming, and it's a huge shock, and it's something that I never would have expected of Marcus Yerster.
Do you know where he is or was? I mean, he's got his house in Hermanus. Was he still in the country? Where exactly is or was Marcus Yerster?
Well, from what I understood, he was mostly between Hermanus and Stellenbosch, where he spent a lot of time too. He would basically flip between those two areas in the Western Cape. And he lived a relatively reclusive lifestyle, although he was being seen out more and more, perhaps an expectation that the criminal charges against him would never see that light of day.
It's interesting you say that, because he gets a fine yesterday of 475 million rand, and then they're all indications that he will appeal this. This is the Marcus Yerster who seemed to be like the Teflon Don who just wouldn't go down. He wouldn't face any charges. We're many years later. We're in 2024. What is your take? Do you think it's just got too much? It was a step too far?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say at this point what would have happened in this particular case. You would have imagined that given his previous conduct where he argued that it was all pretty much a fiction and there were no accounting irregularities or sign-off, that he would have fought the regulator's fine at 475 million to the end. I think what might have prompted any change in his attitude would have been if the hawks finally came knocking at his door, which is something that hasn't happened after 7 years. I think that might have prompted a change from him. But up until now, when he appeared in Parliament, for example, his tune has been that there was nothing wrong at Steinhoff and this was just an unfortunate accident.
And of course, the German police, that warrant of arrest, I'm sure he was worried about that. But let's go back to the NPA and the big reason that was given that it's taken 7 years or there hadn't been any sort of prosecution is because they didn't have capacity to prosecute those kind of crimes after state capture. What's your take?
Well, I mean, certainly it has taken a long time for this thing to wend its way towards any kind of resolution. 7 years is a long time, and in other global frauds, such as Wirecard, we've seen action being taken sooner. Having said that, it is an exceptionally complicated fraud at Steinhoff, and it took a team of many, many forensic accountants a year to wade through the financials and come to their conclusions. But having said that, they did come to those conclusions back in 2019. So why it would take an extra 5 years is perhaps surprising. You'd certainly think that there should have been resolution far sooner.
Yeah. When we started our conversation tonight, you said you're a little bit surprised. The personality, the person of Marcus Yerster, who is he?
Well, essentially, Marcus Yerster was somebody who basically started this company, started various companies. He started Goma Goma, the lounge suite maker. And then he met this German businessman called Bruno Steinhoff, who was looking to expand in South Africa and wanted to build a furniture empire in South Africa. And they got involved, and Steinhoff listed on the JSE in 1998 and did exceptionally well for a number of years. After a while, it became a lot harder for Marcus Yerster to present the financials that showed an incrementally growing company. So ultimately, what happened was that, as all the regulators and the auditors have said, there was 106 billion rand of fictitious transactions put into the company's accounts over more than a decade to kind of bolster the perception that it was this fantastically well-growing company that was delivering returns for shareholders.
Yeah. Now, the Marcus Yerster you speak of, he was quite extravagant as well. He had his racehorses, we remember that. I also remember him being in Parliament, and he answered questions from MPs, and he seemed to run rings around those MPs.
He did to some extent. I mean, as I said, he basically presented this viewpoint that said that there are no accounting irregularities, and prove it. At that stage, it was a very difficult thing for the MPs, certainly, to prove. So what they had to go on in Parliament was they had various elements of the truth. So they could say this appears to have happened. The share price has crashed 87%. And Marcus Yerster just said, yes, well, that isn't actually true. Nothing was wrong. Prove it. It was a failed business deal. One of his business partners who wanted to get even with him by spreading rumors about him. That was the story that he told in Parliament.
Yeah. When was the last time you spoke to Marcus Yerster?
He wouldn't speak to me for years. He basically refused to speak to me and refused to engage. I'd written some fairly negative articles about him back in 2011, and he felt that it was selling his reputation and besmirching him as a upstanding businessman, and refused to engage with me after that.
Yeah, and your book, Stein Heist, I drive along the highway, I see a big billboard there that says Stein Heist, and this grimacing picture of Marcus Yerster, and every time I see that, I can't help but think he must be very angry with you, Rob. After your expose came out, and the series as well on Showmax, was there a situation where he may have responded to you, may have reached out in anger to you, or did he just, there was nothing?
No, there was nothing. I think Marcus Yerster had been advised by his lawyers, and when I spoke to the lawyers, this was the view they had, that he would wait for the right tribunal to defend himself. And certainly, I think engaging with the media was not something he liked particularly, especially if it was something negative. And he thought, and the impression I got was that he was just going to bide his time. He had lots of media requests. He had lots of people who said, who wanted to speak to him. But it wasn't just the media who was all over him. I mean, we had the PwC forensic investigators. We had his successor at Steinhoff. The reports were racking up against him, and there was a definite sense that the net was closing in on him, which perhaps might have been at least partly responsible for today's events.
Yeah, we just don't have the details that go with that. Rob Rose, former editor of the Financial Mail and author of Stein Heist, thank you so much for coming on to the Money Show this evening and giving us some of the details that you do know. We don't know all the five W's and the H, where it happened, when it happened. We don't know much beyond that, but we will continue to bring you those details and perhaps just check in with Rob a little bit later on. Let's stay with the story now, and joining us is independent political analyst Kaya Sotole. Hi, Kai. Good evening.
Good evening, and good evening to the listeners.
Now, we were actually due to speak about the eToll drama, which we will get to now, but your reaction to the Marcus Yerster developments and what you've heard of the past half hour?
Well, I think it is obviously a very abrupt end, and I think what makes it so remarkably abrupt is that for many years, many people just didn't think there would ever be a moment where he was going to be held accountable. And then suddenly, this past few days, we then heard from the FSCA saying they've completed their investigations and coming up with that 475 million rand fine. The expectation was that they were simply going to go through the normal legal processes and take many years to complete. But I think today's developments simply say, well, that is the end of perhaps that anticipated journey of personal accountability. And now all we have to do is reflect on the mess that he created in his buccaneering ways at Steinhoff.
Yeah, I'm looking at my TV screens in front of me, SABC News, EWN, Newsroom Africa. They've all got the story now. It's out in the open and it says former Steinhoff CEO Marcus Joester is dead. Do you have a sense, though, that it's maybe avoiding justice, that a lot of people would have liked to see him pay, some of the other executives pay, because at the end of the day, 200 billion rand is lost, is just wiped away from people, their investments, and I would think a lot of anger.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of anger. And I think, obviously, what has always been missing in the accountability value chain was him actually being held before the appropriate authorities and then ventilating his version of the story. So all we now know is that all these other regulatory agencies who have been empowered to look at some of the transactions and some of the disclosures, make comparisons and say there was a gap here, they've completed their work, whether it was the JSE or whether it was the FSCA. But what was still missing was the simple question of, well, what exactly happened? How did you do it? And why did you do it? And we're expecting the law enforcement agencies in the form of the NPA in particular to pursue that. And I think 6 years down the line, the faith in their capacity.
Sure, Kaya, are you still with us?
Looks like finally put a case together and they were about to arrest him. But that is progress.
Yeah. Sorry, we lost you for a minute there. But talking about the NPA, how confident are you in the NPA of 2024 versus the days of state capture? Because I remember that press statement coming out from the NPA saying, we just don't have the chartered accountants. We just don't have the capacity to investigate this. But finally, now the law's caught up with them.
Well, I think the problem with the capacity of the NPA is multi-pronged. They've got general capacity issues, even when you don't have to deal with cases as complex as this one. And then they also perhaps don't have the right financial forensic skills that will enable them to unpack this case much earlier. I do not believe that the NPA of 2024 is better capacitated than what it was before, because we haven't seen the parliamentary budgets matching that type of increase. So until that gets done, we still are going to be working on hope and speculation that if something similar emerges, they'll still be able to figure it out much faster than what they've done here. But we definitely do know that there's a big capacity gap within the National Prosecuting Authority. And of course, if they did crack this case eventually, the question of how long it took is still going to linger on for longer than for much beyond today.
Yeah, so what we're going to be doing is trying to get hold of also Christo Visso, who lost billions of rands in the whole Steinhoff crash in 2017. Now, Kaya, the reason why we actually got you on the show originally is to talk about eToll. So we're going to park Steinhoff for a little bit, and while our journalists man the phones trying to find out exactly what happened. And Gauteng's eToll drama seems to be never ending. After this intensive fight to scrap eTolls, it's now been agreed that the provincial governments, they'll pay their 30%. That was the original agreement. And the national government will pay 70%. But now we got the Treasury coming forward saying that, hold on a second now, Gauteng will only be paying for the backlog maintenance, with the maintenance costs going forward paid by the national government. But that's the maintenance cost paid for by the national government, not that 70%. Things seem to be getting very blurry. Where do we stand with eTolls in Gauteng?
Well, the problem with eTolls is that the reason it's taken so long is the simple fact that no one has been able to raise the money that is necessary to solve the problem. So a couple of weeks ago, we were deliberating on the fact that the premier of Gauteng kept telling people that eTolls are going to be switched off on 31 March. And I wrote an article and we debated here with Aubrey to say, well, actually, until we see the tangible actions in terms of the gas authorizes eTolls being withdrawn, for example, And the secondary question of figuring out where the money is going to come from, I do not believe that the Premier is in a position to tell us that it's going to switch off e-tolls. And of course, what we've now heard from National Treasury is a simple confirmation of the fact that, well, hold on, until somebody can answer where the money is coming from, this thing is not resolved. So we do have the historical problem, so 12.9 billion rand in relation to e-tolls, and also another 4 billion in relation to a historic maintenance backlog. That is still the sins of the past. We still have to figure out what happens beyond 31 March or whenever the gantries are shut down, who will be responsible for maintaining the Gauteng roads in the future, and of course, whatever other improvements are required, somebody's going to have to deal with them. We now know that it won't be an e-tolls model, but we do not know what the alternative is going to be. So this theory is actually not dead, even though the Premier of Gauteng wishes that it could die overnight.
I also read as well that despite him saying, like you said, the end of this month, that e-tolls will, the gantries will be switched off, but now National Treasury is saying, okay, fine, hold on, the people of Gauteng will be responsible. Now the Premier's also said, well, basically, it'll be the new provincial governments after the 29th of May, after the election, they'll have to deal with it. So it sounds like a big case of pass the buck.
Well, that is precisely the problem, in that what we've seen is that since 2016, actually, ahead of either local or national government elections, there seems to be a sense of urgency within the ANC politicians and Gauteng to simply say, we're going to find a solution to this, we're going to abolish this. And of course, why we know they do that is that it is still a big hot potato politically, because citizens have rebelled against it for over a decade. So it becomes the type of thing that everyone can always say, well, you're the type of government that doesn't listen. So when they keep telling us that they're going to abolish it, it is to simply try and win back some of their political capital. But I think 8 or 9 years down the line, citizens of Gauteng know better than to take ANC politicians on their word when they say this. And the reality here is that we knew exactly what Banyana Josefa was doing in his State of the Province address. We knew exactly what he was doing when he said that we've now signed with Jacob Mamabolo a solution to this. He was playing into the political gallery without actually showing us a check. And the simple answer is that this is moving from a national balance sheet to the provincial balance sheet. So Gauteng citizens are going to be fully responsible for this. Whether he tells them now, the 29th of May, that is the answer that's going to happen.
This, though, I would think could blow up nastily in their face. And I say this because after power cuts and no water in the city of Joburg, if this e-toll saga is not resolved as well, it could be just one more nail in the ANC's coffin going into the elections on the 29th of May.
Yes, it is. And I think the great gamble that Banyaza Lesufi took this time is that he wanted to give the impression that a solution had been found. But for National Treasury to come out and explicitly and say, oh, by the way, Gauteng citizens, when he says that the solution has been found, he's essentially taking it from the national balance sheet to the provincial balance sheet. So therefore, you are now only, as citizens of Gauteng, ever going to be responsible for this. I think it's actually made the situation much worse, because if I'm sitting as a citizen of the province thinking, wait, hold on, you said it was a solution, but it's actually you transferring this obligation from the national balance sheet of SANRAL to a provincial balance sheet without explaining how it's going to be funded. And the simple answer is that you either have to redirect to the existing budget, or you have to extract more from us Gauteng citizens. Now tell us how you're going to do it, and of course you're not going to be happy about it. So I do think that it has backfired, because the reality is that the money was never there in the first place.
Gosh, it's going to be a very interesting 3 months coming up to that national election. Kai Sotole, independent political analyst, thank you so much for your insight on The Money Show this evening.
Your voice.
Your station. Let's walk the talk.
702.
702.
Right, we'll continue with The Money Show, keeping an eye on that Marcus Eustace story. Now, South Africa's massive 943 billion rand infrastructure investment is good news for the zinc sector. Reading up about this today, it's good for the construction industry as well and manufacturing, but the zinc sector is set to benefit from this. On the line is Simon Norton, who's the director of the International Zinc Association. Hi, Simon. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Good evening, Ray, and thank you very much for the invitation.
So, this is a lovely 943 billion rand infrastructure investment project. Where does zinc place itself in South Africa's economic recovery? And I'm thinking this could be a great sort of light for the zinc industry.
Well, firstly, South Africa's got very rich resources in terms of minerals of zinc in the Northern Cape. And then once it's been removed, so forth, dug out of the ground, it gets refined. We used to have zinc refineries, a refinery in South Africa, but it's sent offshore. But zinc plays a role in its purest form, which we call refined zinc, where it's coated onto steel in what's known as hot-dip galvanizing or continuous galvanizing. So they take steel, dip it into molten zinc. Once it coats onto the surface of the steel, it's ready to be installed, and of course it then protects the steel against corrosion. And we've got a very long coastline and many corrosive areas, so that's where it fits in.
Okay, interesting. So where do we mine our zinc? Where does it come from?
All of our zinc is mined in the Northern Cape at what's known as Gamsberg, and there's a new mine that's just about on the point of starting at Prieska in the Northern Cape. It's an old Anglo-American mine that was revamped by a company called Orion. And then there's another company called Vedanta. They own Hindustan Zinc. They've got big operations at Gamsberg in the Northern Cape, and the ore is then sent offshore to be refined.
And Simon, where do you see the zinc industry going in the next couple of years? Yes, we do have an election. I suppose our new government will have a totally different, maybe not maybe the same, but totally different outlook on investment and also building infrastructure. But where do you see things going?
Well, you know, zinc, few people realize this, but zinc is a very good barometer of what's actually happening in the construction and civil engineering industry. When we had a zinc refinery in South Africa, which was a very old plant, it closed down in 2011, we started importing zinc from a variety of countries around the world. So we import zinc from South Korea, Kazakhstan, and Brazil. And it's all used in either hot-dip galvanizing or continuous galvanizing, and provided there's an outlet for this in terms of steel, for mining, construction, civil engineering, water plant, well, the industry can go as far as it likes.
Sure. Sounds very, very, very interesting. Simon Norton, Director of the International Zinc Association of South Africa, thank you so much for coming on to The Money Show. It's good to get some investment news for a change, some positive developmental news, because at the moment I'm looking at my TV screens, there's at least two developing news stories which perhaps are not good news. Simon Norton, thank you so much for coming on to The Money Show. It's just gone 6:30.
Your voice.
Your station. Let's walk the talk.
702.
702.
Right, coming up with The Money Show shortly, talking about higher education institutions and how they can redefine their value proposition. And I'm talking more about basically what happens with thousands of students apply to universities every year, looking for the best way to study. But they want to go to that university that's got the computer thing going. They want the latest technology. We live in a rapidly changing environment with technology speeding forward, changing the way that we study. So for many, it's online. For others, they need in-person training. And of course, the many universities also saying that we don't want to defy the principles that we've always had. On the line is Professor Magnati Ntombela, who's the principal of Mancosa. Professor, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
Hey, good evening. Good evening.
Good to have you on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good evening to as well.
So, how has Mancosa changed the way it operates over the past decade? Have you had to redefine yourselves?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Mancosa was founded in 1995 by Professor Yusuf Karodia. And the aim from the start was to offer education, quality education, especially to the previously disadvantaged. We live in a changing world, as you've just said, and a lot has changed in the last decade. In fact, in the last few years. And so being a distance education institution, we define ourselves as supported distance education for many reasons, which I may explain later on if I get a chance. You were asking about changes. I don't even know where to start. But when we view changes, we view them from our strategic intent to be a student-centric institution. So all the changes, our aim is to make sure that or enhance the student experience.
Sure, Professor. It's a bit of a bad line, if I can just ask you to move around a little bit. The cell phone gremlins are getting into the phone system. Right, there we go. Let's see if we can get you back on the line as well. Oh, right, Professor, is that a better line? Hi, there we go.
I'm here.
Yes.
Is it better now?
There we go. Much better. You were saying. Go for it.
Yeah. I was saying that we view all the changes that we are talking about from our strategic intent to be a student-centric institution. So when we look at the cohort of students that we get nowadays, we recognize that they are digital animals. They are living in the context of an ever increasing pace of technology advancement. But we decide on which technologies to use.
I tell you what we're going to do, Professor. We're just battling. We're going to actually redial the number and see if we can get hold of you. Professor Magnatia Ntombela, who's the principal of Mancosa, saying it's been going since 1995. But if you think about computers coming into the country, I mean, I remember working in early newsrooms, and I kid you not, we had typewriters. Then we went to this green computer system. I call it green because the screen was green, and it was manually typing everything out, and then all of a sudden we had Windows, and on we went and on we went. All right, Professor, let's give it another go. Right, you were saying you had to change things since 1995.
Yes. Some of the changes, I mean, there are two sources of the changes. One was, I mean, is the advancing or advances in technology, and the second one is how the world changed with the COVID-19. So if we start with the technology, there are many amazing technologies out there which can enhance the learning. And I was saying that from our standpoint, we adopt those as long as they enhance our strategic intent to be a student-centric institution.
No, absolutely. It's a very difficult thing to do. So take us through some of the changes that you've had to bring in, because very often, we, like you said, after COVID-19, everybody wanted to stay at home. Nobody wanted to go to varsity or to work, and they thought this was the new normal.
Oh, yeah. You see, our student body has got working students and also full-time students. So the change brought about by COVID-19 mainly included us having to provide virtual classes. And the advantage of that was that it gave us the flexibility to actually offer recorded classes or live classes, depending on the situation of the student. As I said, that we are very strong on being student-centric. And also, with our staff, as you'll remember, COVID redefined what is called a workplace. It meant that you can work from wherever you are. We are a big institution with a footprint in 5 provinces in South Africa and also in some SADC countries. That agility made us able to deliver quality programs through technology.
Yeah, it actually would, because you probably thought COVID-19, everyone's remote learning. Will we do this anyway? But it is still so nice to have that in-person contact with a lecturer who basically, I know like sometimes there's like 100 people in a lecture hall, but it's nice to have that in-person training when that person can come up to you and say, you're doing it wrong, do it this way.
That's true. To try and accommodate that, we really believe in the community of learners. So we still use technology. We use WhatsApp groups. We use email. We use any. I mean, as I was just before I talked to you, I was looking at our WhatsApp group on queries, where you can actually state what your query is, and we've got teams that are always, even on weekends, ready to respond to your query. So we actually are very strong at responding to our students' needs, because we know that they are very diverse. There are people who can sit in their offices and work. There are people who are in rural areas who struggle with connectivity and so on. So whenever they get a chance, they are able to connect with an academic, to connect with an administrator who will guide them through the process.
That's great.
In fact, yeah. before they start, because we know that not all of them come from the same backgrounds and so on. We have got many induction and orientation programs to make sure that they understand our systems, they can feel comfortable tackling their modules.
Yeah.
And also, we are always at the end of the email or...
Yeah, which is good. You see, I think that's the big thing, to be at the end of a telephone line or an email. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to throw stones at any other institutions, but they have been accused of not getting back to students because there are so many. So it is still that personal touch. Professor, 5 years' time, 10 years' time, where do you see Mancosa going?
Mancosa, I'm very optimistic that we're on the right path, and I see Mancosa getting stronger and stronger. You know that the main challenge we're faced with now is that we are preparing students for the world that changes all the time. So we're preparing them for the future that nobody is sure of, but we have got so many programs in place to make sure that because our vision says that we are educating for a better world for all, we just want to make sure that our programs really give students the competences and the skills that will enable them to operate comfortably in the new world, no matter what. In fact, we expect them to be shapers of our world, yeah.
Are we hoping so? We need new leaders, Professor Magnati Ntombela, who's the principal of Mancosa. Thanks for coming on to The Money Show. And that's the big thing, having new decisive leaders, especially with an election coming up. And looking at some of our political leaders as well, I'm sure you may agree that it's time to get young blood in there, fresh new minds in, to lead this country, to come up with solutions when it comes to electricity, when it comes up to water provision, and just basically running this country. Thank you so much, Professor, for coming on to The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
Right, talking climate change now, and a rather dynamic program by the United Nations Development Fund is at the fore. The UNDP's Weather Kids are being backed by global celebrities and the World Meteorological Organization. The initiative showcases a rather sobering forecast from 2050 when it comes to climate change. We need to do something about this. It's so very important. Well, joining us to discuss this is Maxwell Gomera, who's the President Representative at the United Nations Development Programme. Maxwell, hi, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. Oh, we don't have Maxwell. We seem to have lost him. It comes down to climate change and what we're going to do about it. And at the moment, I mean, I know Johannesburg and Cape Town, the heat here has been something else. It really has been quite hectic. So I'll be chatting about climate change. Now, this campaign aired in over 80 countries, also urges viewers to take action and align financial decisions with sustainability to secure a livable future for generations to come. And they do cite 2050, about the basically saying that we should go up by about 2 or 3 degrees in temperature. And you're probably saying to yourself, well, that's not a lot, really. Well, it is when you start seeing tsunamis and you start seeing the oceans heating up and hurricanes and all sorts of knock-on effects that come from that. So it is a major problem. I'd like to know from the UN, though, what about the big countries like United States or China? These are the big guys who emit all these greenhouse gases. And let's be honest about it as well. You have to do something. It's all good for you and I not to emit those greenhouse gases. But what about the bigger ones, the huge ones who basically, you know, hundreds of tons worth of greenhouse gases? So I'll be chatting to the United Nations Development Fund about this one. Some of your WhatsApps while we try to get them on the line. Tina Pullen says, hi, Ray. Dear Ray, modern technology, Tina says, I remember the first computers coming into commercial banks, very rudimentary in its offerings in the late 1970s. Why is South Africa so far behind in using it in our government and schools? You see, Granny T, I think this is a bit of a problem. We do have them in our schools. I do know that they had the whole rollouts with iPads for Gauteng schools, but the problem was is a lot of those iPads were taken, were stolen, and this was a big problem when it came to education. So the Gauteng Education Department specifically, and I'll sort of throw a bit of light his way, under Panyazo Lesufi, when he was then Education MEC, he did try very, very hard to do this. And we are at the forefront of this technology. In fact, I was chatting to a friend of mine who has been in the banks for many, many, many years. And he said, you know, from the start, I think he worked for Absa Bank. Let's give them a bit of a plug, Absa Bank. And he was saying that basically they've had the best technologies. They've had the best ever since then. And it's kudos to know also our banking systems as well. I mean, have you heard of somebody trying to hack a banking system? It just doesn't happen because the technology that they have there is top-notch. And we were chatting to the professor from Mancosa, and he was saying exactly the same thing, that they've kept up to date with technology. It's easier, though, for him, though, because they've been doing it for many, many years because they've got all these satellite campuses. So it's easy for them because they've known how to do it. And, of course, COVID-19 comes along, and you see exactly the same thing. And, yeah, here we go. Another one from Godwin. He says, stop climate change, Ray. Get the mongrel United States to shut down the operations. That's Godwin. Well, you see, that is the thing as well. The problem is, the last time we had one of these climate change conferences, the United States were not a signatory to that. Now there was China. And that's where things go totally wrong. So we're going to have to do something. We've had, what was her name? Greta Thunberg saying, hysterically saying, you know, we have to do something now. And she was right in what she said. But, my big question to the United Nations is, is anybody listening to this? So hopefully we will get them before the end of the show. It looks like we're battling to get hold of them. In the meantime, though, looking at this Steinhoff story, and it's all over. I'm looking at all the various news wires from News 24. Everybody's got it. Carrying the same story, sources can reveal that the former CEO of Steinhoff, Markus Juster, has taken his life. Apparently, there was an arrest. And according to all the different reports, he shot himself during this arrest. We are trying to get independent confirmation. We're just trying to get details. Obviously, what happens with news agencies is they go out there and they've got their sources. Every single news agency has got a source. And they will speak to friends or family. They will speak to former colleagues. They'll speak to people within the NPA. And that's exactly what we're trying to do, just to get somebody to go on air for us to say this happened, how it happened, and when it happened as well. Somebody else I'd like to speak to is Christo Visser. Now, Christo Visser, he was the head of ShopRite, and at that point, what happened is he bought Steinhoff shares just a while before the whole thing collapsed. And he went to Markus Juster and he said, I'm going to trade in a whole lot of my company for Steinhoff shares. And Markus Juster apparently knew about the shenanigans. This is what sort of went in the media, that he knew about what was going on. And he knew full well that Christo Visser would be giving him money for these shares, but there was a risk attached. And I stand to be corrected, but I think it was around 2 billion rand that Christo Visser lost after this. And he basically invested all this money into Steinhoff and converting it into shares, losing 2 billion rand. There was also the case of Techie Town. Now, Techie Town, you would have seen them. They sell shoes and stuff like that. And the CEO there at Techie Town, the same thing as well. I will sell you the company. You'll get a stake in this company of Techie Town. If you sell me, we exchange it for Steinhoff shares. And what happens in 2017, I think it was December when this whole thing crashed, those shares went to nothing. I think they went from like 90 rand a share down to about 2 cents a share. They crashed all the way down. And these guys lost their money. They lost billions, millions and billions of rands. And that was the big thing. It was quite hectic. It really was. And eventually, you know, these guys came to the media and they said, Christo Visser spoke to me actually on The Money Show, saying, you know, he was angry about it. He had managed to recover. He's got other projects, other money. He did bounce back. But imagine losing 2 billion rand. That's a lot of money, and I think the anger that goes with this. So these reports now that Marcus Yoster has taken his own life, we will, of course, try and get clarity on this. And, of course, Eyewitness News working round the clock to bring you these latest details. But we do need to clarify and bring you sound information that we can stand by. It's just gone 7 o'clock.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
7 minutes past 7 o'clock, and The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Ray White in for Bruce Whitfield this evening, and keeping a close eye, you would have heard now in Eyewitness News that the police will be issuing a statement about the death or the apparent death. We need to know. We need to have the police say it, I suppose. But, you know, looking at all the various news sources, from News 24 to SABC News to everyone just seems to have this. And like I said before, news offices, newsrooms have got their sources, and it seems to be playing out. There's an SMS or a WhatsApp message from Wanga who's come in saying, "Hi, Ray and 702, regarding Marcus Yoster, couldn't he afford the fine? Was he broke?" Well, here's the thing, though. He did manage to sell his shares right before the crash. And if anything, they could have gone in for insider trading. So he did have a lot of his money. But, you know, 475 million rand is a lot of money. So that's number one. Number two, I think if you are facing arrest, I think finally, after seven years since 2017, you've been living with us that the NPA at any moment can knock at your door and they can say you're under arrest. I think to live with that fear, that anxiety, that expectation must be quite something. Must be really, really difficult to live with. And latest report saying that he took his life during arrest. We spoke to Rob Rose earlier on. He's the author of Steinheist. You can see that on Showmax. In fact, I recommend you watch that. Talks about Steinhoff and what happened with Steinhoff. And if you go through that, you can see exactly what the situation was. And 200 billion rand wiped off the books. And a lot of people are saying on the SMS line, saying, "Ray, how does that work? How exactly does that work?" Well, in answer to your question, Michelle, how that works is that, say, for instance, you go buy a share price and it's one share, costs 100 rand. You think, okay, 100 rand, and maybe that company does really well. Then all of a sudden that share, there's been confidence in that share, so it goes to 110 rand. So now you've made yourself 10 rand. Well, that's how it is. And then you keep investing in shares that you think are going to do well. Sometimes you'll hear us in our market reports, we'll say the all share is down on the day, and there are elements within the all share index like mining or financials, they start to go down, and perhaps your share is among those financials. And then you think to yourself, okay, I've lost a little bit of money. But don't go and sell it, you see, because that share price can still go up. So that's how the equity market works. Things go up and things go down. And if you're very clever, you will sell when it's way up and you can make some money. But the problem that happened on that day is that the German police, they got wind that there was some sort of fraud, and there was a raid on Steinhoff's offices in Germany. And this, of course, the markets learnt about this. Now, there's no confidence now in the share price, and they just collapsed. Everything just collapsed. And it went from, say, 100 rand a share, we'll use that example, down to about 2 cents a share. Now, imagine you've got a billion rand in shares, or a million rand, or even 10,000 rand in shares. You've now lost all your money. Just evaporated. It's gone. And the problem was the Public Investment Corporation, these are the guys who basically take all these civil servants' money and they put them into a pension fund with, I think, like 3 trillion rand now. It could be more. Trillions and trillions of rands. And they invested all this money, you see. And some of the money, not all of it, just a little bit of the money, went into Steinhoff. And I talk about a little bit, so I'm talking about hundreds of millions of rand, went into investing into Steinhoff. And that money was lost as well. So you would have had COSATU, you would have had SAFTU, the big union federation, saying, this is not acceptable. This cannot be happening. And that's exactly it. People lost a lot of money. Some people had their life savings in Steinhoff. I mean, I remember listening to Bruce on The Money Show, and it was Steinhoff this and Steinhoff sign off that. And you had these very intelligent guys who came from Stellenbosch, one being Marcus Joosten, and he got together with Christo Visser, and they started this furniture manufacturer, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. Then they went overseas and they started buying up, I think it was, I'm trying to think of the name of it, in the UK. In fact, I was in the UK recently and I saw it there. I'm trying to think of the name of that company, and they bought that up as well. Now, you know Pepcor, Pep Stores, that was Christo Visser's, and he said, okay, I tell you what, I'll buy some Steinel shares. In exchange, you can have some of Pepcor. And that's what happened. But everybody lost their money. And that was the big problem. This whole house of cards fell. And eventually, Steinhoff was almost no more. They've had Steinhoff Africa. And they did regroup. And I watched the share price there from time to time. I think it went up to 5 Rand at some point. I think some money came back. I know that a lot of creditors were also paid as well. A lot of people got their money back. Not some of their money back, but many, many people lost millions, in fact, billions, if I'm talking about Christo Visser. They lost all of this money. It was absolutely gone. So a lot of people are very angry with Marcus Joosten. He continued living in the meantime. He continued living in Hermanus. And every once in a while, if you drove past his house, he had this big white, sort of white walls that come around his house there. And there were these swear words or death threats or things spray painted on the white walls that went around his house. And I think he was living in fear as well. There was talk that he would go into the local town once in a while and people would recognize him. He had his baseball cap on. But I think he also feared for his life because he thought that somebody was going to come for him at some point, some angry investor who had lost all that money. And it's just very sad. It really, really is sad to see what has happened now, because will there be justice? Will others also be prosecuted as well? Because he didn't act alone. But the one thing we do know, that he had his money, he sold his shares, he got out just about 2 days before, and that's exactly what happened. So it's very, very sad to see what happens, but that is the story of Marcus Joosten.
Because this journey is better taken together.
Let's walk the talk. 702.
Now, South Africa's battled over the past 30 years to correct the evils of racial segregation. The National Empowerment Fund is celebrating 20 years of fostering black economic development and job creation. The figures are impressive. Now, since inception, the NEF has approved 1,603 transactions, totaling more than 14.1 billion rand. Through strategic investments and partnerships as well, the organization has facilitated the creation of over 121,000 jobs. On the line is NEF chairperson, Dr. Ntabi Singh Moleko. Hi, Doctor. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. Doctor, are you with us? Oh, looks like we'll have to get the doctor up on The Money Show. Some gremlins getting into our phone lines this evening. But it is very interesting with the NEF, and I was reading up about it. Additionally, 24 strategic and industrial projects valued at 12.6 billion rand have been initiated with the potential to support over 52,000 jobs. And we're looking at job creation. We're looking at to make sure that we have jobs in our country. And I must admit, it is actually quite something. It is, quite something. All right, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to park that interview and let's go on to our next one.
Your voice,
your station. Let's walk the talk.
702.
702.
All right, so from the NEF to small business. Now, small business focus tonight, the necessity of startups. And talking startups, they are so essential to see to drive the country, especially when it comes to job creation. But they do need strategies. You can't just have your startup, you see. Along with you need your venture capital. Joining us to discuss this is Clive Butko, who's the co-founder of Conducive Capital. Hi, Clive. Good evening. Welcome to 702.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce, and good evening to all your listeners.
Hi, it's Ray speaking. We've given Bruce the day off. In fact, it's quite funny. He was sending me pictures from London late last night to tell me where he went to have dinner and all the rest of it. So there we go. We do wish him well, but you're with Ray this evening. Tell us, Clive, about a startup. What do you need to take into account when you've got your idea, you've got your startup, but then what?
You know, I think number one is I think most startups, and, you know, I reiterate this many, many times, it's not about raising capital. You know, raising capital doesn't validate your business model. And too many startups think it's all about raising capital. I know you spoke about some very impressive numbers on the Empowerment Fund. But I think it really is getting to understand the customer problem, because what too many entrepreneurs do, and I've seen it in South Africa, I've been in venture capital for the last 12 years. I've been building businesses for 40 years now. And too many entrepreneurs fall in love with a solution. They don't fall in love with the problem that they're solving. So rather than fall in love with the product that you're developing, rather go and speak to customers and really understand the problem and the need and the pain and the solution that you're actually creating. And if entrepreneurs to just change this mindset, rather go outside into your company, rather going inside out, you know, build it and they will come, because they don't. So you can have a great idea, but ideas are worth, they're not worth anything. It's all about the execution. So raising capital, get out there, understand the problem, the bigger problem you can make. Like I'm a tech investor, the bigger problem you can solve, the bigger pain point you can solve, you can go and you can sell, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of these products, and actually build a very, very scalable, hopefully a unicorn one day.
Mm. You're quite right, because very often, Clive, people get involved or too wrapped up in their own ideas, and then they get very excited about this, and they can't seem to find out why they're not making any money.
Absolutely. You know, one of the most important things I say, right? I mean, you know, everyone says, well, what do I need to know as a startup? And I say, Warren Buffett said accounting is the language of business. And it's absolutely essential that you have an understanding of your finances. So too many entrepreneurs in South Africa say to me, no, but my accountant's going to do that. I say, no. Your accountant can do the journal entries and they can do your cash, your balance sheet income statement and your cash flow statement. But you have got to know your unit economics. You've got to know what it's costing you to acquire a customer. You've got to know what the lifetime value is of your customer. You've got to know what the churn rates of your customer. You're the entrepreneur. You're the businessman. You have got to know that those numbers. And if you come to me for money, I'll tell you something. If you can't answer those questions, I'm having a very short conversation. I'm not investing in you. So it's a critical part, and I'm going to really impart this to any entrepreneur listening tonight. Know your numbers. You absolutely have to get on top of your numbers, because if you don't know them, I'm not going to know them better than you, and I'm not going to be your accountant.
Yeah. What sort of help is then available to those startups who don't even think about something like that, know your numbers? I mean, what help is available?
You know, I think you have to speak to the right people. You know, one thing I've always modeled my life on successful businesses. And, you know, just learn the lessons from success and failure. And I always say to everyone that success leaves clues. So, you know, if success leaves clues, go and model yourself on those people that have been successful. Go and stand on the shoulders of giants that have been there before you. And there's a lot of, obviously, there's a lot of content out there on YouTube and, you know, whatever. There's so much content. But the best thing to do is get the best advisors, get the best mentors. So if I look at Conducive Capital, I mean, what sets us apart as a company, and I'm the managing partner of Conducive Capital, which we've just launched. You know, we don't just invest, we partner. You know, we build strategic guidance and industry expertise, and we provide mentorship, we provide advice, we provide knowledge, and we empower startups to take on the entrepreneurial journey. And I think that's what a startup actually needs. It might not be venture capital funding, it might be angel funding, it might just be someone in your network, it might be someone from your bank, it might be someone from your past, but just find someone that's ahead of you on the journey. You don't have to pay your own school fees. Rather, they've paid their school fees. And one of the points I raise is, you know, you can always take other people's money, but taking money doesn't actually justify your business model. It doesn't make you successful. But the most important thing is I call OPE, which is other people's experience. So the most important thing I would say to any entrepreneur, find someone that's ahead of you on the journey and go and pick their brain, let them mentor you, let them guide you, and just stand on that shoulder of those giants, because that is how they can compress years of work into months, if not days, if not hours. Just because they've been there before and they've done it before and they've learned from success and failure.
Yeah. All right. You are the co-founder, like you said, of Conducive Capital. Take us through the journey of setting up your own business. Was it difficult? You got partners as well. Take us through the process.
Let me just, maybe if I just rewind for a second. So the mission of Conducive Capital, I was the CEO of founder of Kaelin Richard Partners from where I resigned in December. We raised about R250 million. It was a Section 12 J company. I decided in December to actually move on and set up a new venture capital company called Conducive Capital. I've partnered with a guy called Mitch Adams. Mitch is one of the co-founders of one of the top payments companies, Ozo, in South Africa. And Mitch and I have both got we're both entrepreneurs and we're both businessmen and commercially oriented, opposed to engineers or opposed to accountants and anything like that. So the mission of Conducive Capital is really to invest in high potential technology companies and really tackle South Africa's biggest problems. You know, it's quite interesting. Right? I mean, South Africa is a country of unbelievable promise. You know, we're teeming with brilliant minds and untapped opportunities. And the problem I see too often is these visionaries, they lack not only the financial resources, but they also lack the support to turn their ideas into reality. What we did, we said, well, how are we going to be different? We don't want to be like everyone else and just be a financial provider. So we actually set up Conducive Capital to actually add mentorship, guidance. Mitch, my partner's got a venture builder. And we set up, so we launched the company. We've set it up from a CRPC point of view. We're now speaking to a number of investors, and now we're looking at hopefully closing our first round of $50 million by July. And we are speaking to a number of investors. There is a lot of interest. We are an empowered fund. And then we hopefully, by the end of next year, December, we'll raise $50 million. And that's predominantly to invest in this unbelievable innovation and these minds we're seeing in South Africa. The biggest shortage, Ray, we see in South Africa is lack of capital. We have great entrepreneurs. We have great ideas, but we just don't have sophisticated capital. Capital that can actually not only invest capital, but they can help you take your business from zero to 100 in a much quicker time than you know, you could take it yourself.
Sure. You see, that's the problem, though. Now, I love the fact that you've got investors. That sounds good. But if you're thinking about those small enterprises, I've got a single idea, but then I go to a bank, and a bank says, all right, what's your credit history? Can you pay me back? Is there enough support there from the IDF, others as well, that they basically give you enough support that you can have a venture capital, that you'll get that from banks? Because without that, you're dead in the water.
You know, it's interesting. It's a good point you're raising there. But just to give you an idea, we see 100 companies from my last 12 years of being directly involved in venture capital. I worked in Silicon Valley many years ago. We invest in about 1 in 100 companies. So you've got 1% chance of actually raising capital from a venture capitalist. But raising capital, you know, it does not equal a good business. And not raising capital, those 99 businesses that I don't invest in, they're not bad businesses. They're just not venture capital investable businesses. And it's quite hard for me to articulate that sometimes to the entrepreneur. They feel like they've failed, but they haven't failed. Not a good business does not equal a venture capital investable business. If you're a services business or you want to build a one-man show or a five-man show, it's great. It's fantastic. You spoke about job creation. This country is going to get out of its mess, and we hope to help that by Conducive Capital, because we're not only investing in entrepreneurs in this country, in companies. We're investing in South Africa's future, increasing the GDP, increasing the fiscus, helping with job creation. If I look at my previous fund, the one I resigned from in December, we created hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jobs with the capital that we deployed. So we're looking at doing that as well, except we're going to get a hell of a lot more hands-on involvement to help these businesses to be even more successful. So this is what it's all about. You know, you have to find, it doesn't, venture capital, angel investing, and there also are a number of institutions in South Africa. You mentioned the National Empowerment Fund. There's a lot of grant fund which is non-dilutive capital. So you get R1 million, but you don't actually have to pay it back, and it doesn't dilute your equity in your company. So entrepreneurs or small businesses, let's say, they need to find out where they can actually access some capital. And particularly, you know, from an empowerment point of view, there really are many, many avenues in South Africa. I wish there were more. You know, really, I'm pleading to everyone listening to this call tonight, you know, to allocate more capital to people like myself and people in the deploying capital to these small businesses, because that's exactly what this country needs.
Yeah. Are we strict enough, though, when granting capital to certain companies? I mean, sometimes you'll get government stepping in and saying, we want to have some sort of project. Here's your R1 million, go and do it. Are the checks and balances, though, there in place to make sure that there is a return on this? Because it can't just be the responsibility of the private sector to pick up the ball every time.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You know, one of the problems I've experienced in my last, I was the CEO of Accenture South Africa. I spent 28 years there, and I've been working there, and I built many companies around the world, and I built many companies in the last, I've probably been involved in building and on the board and advising about 100 tech companies. And I think one of the biggest concerns you've got is, I think we don't have the right skills deploying the capital, because it's all well and good having the capital, but you need the right skills to be able to know how to pick the winners, how to deploy the capital, and then how to help these businesses grow, employ people, build 100 people business, 200, 500, and 1,000. Someone asked me last night in an interview, are we going to see, you know, the next unicorns coming out of South Africa? And I don't see there's any reason why we're not going to see these unicorns. But we do need more people that know how to deploy capital. It's not just giving you capital. If you lose the money, you lose the money. That's the wrong attitude. We've got to have exactly what you said. If I deploy capital to you, you've got to return me 5, 10x return on my capital. And you've got to create so many jobs. And you've got to increase the fiscus. So I think there needs to be more accountability from these agencies, particularly in government, for the deployment of that capital.
Yeah. Also the skills as well. You need to make sure that you're not losing your skills. What's worrying me the most is that we're having a look at individuals of multiple races leaving our country. And these are the tech skills that we're seeing going. It's got to be a better plan when it comes to this.
You know, we're actually seeing it both ways. You know, I'm in Cape Town at the moment, and it's just unbelievable. I'm sitting in these coffee shops in the morning working and speaking to people who have actually done the opposite. They say, Cape Town is a magnificent place. They want to come and work. So they're coming from all over Europe, all over America, and they're actually starting their businesses here and employing South Africans. We're seeing people outflow, but we're actually seeing an inflow as well. But I think, it's just interesting. If we look at the NASDAQ, 51% of the CEOs on the NASDAQ are actually immigrants to America. They actually endorse the immigrants coming into America to start these businesses and hiring hundreds of thousands of people. I really believe the government, from an immigration point of view, needs to endorse them more and bring these really smart people, these entrepreneurs, to our shores in South Africa. Let them start the businesses. Let them hire those hundreds and hundreds of people. But that's where I think we're getting blocked up. I think that from a government point of view, I really hope someone's listening from the Labor Department. Let's bring these people in and help build these next level of unions.
Yeah, because as you say that, I'm thinking about Home Affairs. We've had problems with visas, and we had the whole 90-day extension and people going home saying, I'm going back to Europe. I don't want to be here because I can't sort out my visa. We've got to get this right. We've got to do better.
Absolutely. And I can't believe we can't do better. But it's got to be, you know, there's got to be that the desire to actually fix this problem. Because by fixing this problem, I think we can turn this. We've got a 40% unemployment rate. Every job we create, let's say we invest in one business. They employ one person. That's one person less that's unemployed. But they can employ hundreds of people. So if we don't get those visa stuff sorted out and the Department of Labor sorted out, we really are, you know, we're shooting ourselves in both feet. I wish I could get more involved in helping the government, just some of these initiatives, that we can really be more, you know, rather than being red tape, let's move it to red carpet. Let's be a red carpet for immigrants coming to this country and starting out their businesses.
That'll be very nice. It really would be. But just to sum up our conversation, to anyone who is listening to this, they've got the idea, they've got their business idea. To sum it up, what do they need to do in, say, 2 or 3 easy steps?
I think first and foremost, you need to, let's just say from a governance or a structure point of view, you need to get it set up with CRPC, your tax, your empowerment credentials, get that all sorted out. So that's the easy part. That's just technical. Just pay someone a few thousand rand, let them do that for you, because you need to be registered under SIPC, et cetera. I think the next thing you need to do is, you've got this great idea, go and test the market. Don't start building. Let's say that's a tech idea. Don't start trying to raise money or going to your family and friends and fools and raising capital. Go and test the idea. Go and speak to 50 clients. Go and ask them, you know, I'm going to solve this problem. Show them a PowerPoint presentation. Show them just a proof of concept done on a straw man model. And so I'm building this. Would this solve the problem for you? Would you pay for this? And it's amazing when you do that. We call it customer discovery and customer development. So you go and speak to your customers. And once they tell you, yes, I really like this. Maybe it would look like this and not like this. Change this widget to be like this. And I will pay you for that. That is the best way you can actually get your business going. So you know, too many entrepreneurs in South Africa, they try to raise capital and they start building technology. And I said, well, who are you solving this problem for? No. People will buy it. I said, well, which people will buy it? Who have you spoken to? No, I've spoken to no one. I said, no, you've done this in the wrong sequence. Go and speak to those customers. Find out that you're solving a problem. Find out that you're helping them meet a need. Find out that you're alleviating a pain. And then, if 100 of them tell you, 50 of 100 tell you that you're solving a problem, you now know you're actually building, you're building something that's actually going to work. You're building the dog food that the dogs are going to eat.
So that's
the sequence you have to do. Once you've got that, then go and build the product. Irrespective, it doesn't have to be a tech product. It doesn't matter what it is, but the sequence is the wrong way around. So all this capital gets used up. They're then desperate for capital, and there's no one buying the dog food, unfortunately.
I love it. Get your sequence right, Clive Butko. Thank you so much. Co-founder of Conducive Capital. Clive, all the best for the future with Conducive. Thanks for taking the time to chat to us on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
And our headmaster tonight at our investment school is Gary Boyson, who's the director at Rand Swiss. Hey, Gary, how's it going?
Yeah, hey, Ray. Good to be on the show.
Well, I must admit, it's been quite a dramatic show this evening. We kind of thought it's Human Rights Day today and it'll be quiet and nothing would be going on. And of course, tonight we're talking about taking risk and rewards, risk versus reward in investing. And this whole Marcus Yoster story broke at about 5:30 this afternoon. And I couldn't help but thinking, we'll be talking about risk and reward, but there was a lot of risk there and little reward at the end. Things can go totally wrong, can't they?
No, absolutely. And I only heard the news when I walked into studio this evening. So absolutely shocking, to be sure. But I suppose we're going to talk about it. Risk reward. It's always a trade off, right? And the way that we look at it in financial markets is essentially what's called the efficient frontier. So if you have low risk, you expect low reward. If you have medium risk, you expect a medium reward. And there's kind of this curve that goes up. But when you have something like Steinhoff, where there's actual underlying fraud to the company, you're taking high risk and there's no chance of a return. And it's a suboptimal investment. It's something that you should try and avoid at all costs.
Well, you wouldn't know. I don't think Christo Visser thought when he was going to place his couple of billion and getting his Steinhoff shares that was going to happen. Also, Techie Town as well. We were talking about that. But you're right. That's fraud. So let's park that to one side because it's not really what we're talking about. Talking about risk and reward in investing. What should you look for, I think, if you have a portfolio and you've got some money, say you've made some money, you've got some money and you want to invest and there's a portfolio out there. What should you look for? Where should you start?
Well, I suppose you should probably start with your personal situation as well. So it's so often we get asked this question, we ask the question, someone calls in, they say, I've made some money and I want to invest it. And the first thing we ask is, well, can you give us a little bit about your situation? What are your objectives? It's actually crazy how many people come back and say, well, no, I don't want to tell you that. Just tell me about different investments. And you're like, I've kind of walked into a doctor's office and said, I'm sore. And you say, okay, where are you sore? No, I'm not telling you that.
I'm just sore.
I'm just sore. Fix it. So that can be a bit tricky. But the first place to really start is who are you? What is your background? What are you trying to achieve? That's really the key thing that you need to understand, because everyone is different. And all portfolios along that efficient frontier that we've just talked about. Yeah, my background was originally from a securities broking side, so it didn't really matter to me where on the curve it sat. I mean, there's good low risk investments, there's good medium risk investments, there's good high risk investments, and what you're really trying to avoid is, as I say, those Steinhoff investments. What you're spending all your time trying to understand is where are the real risks of the bum investments, the failed investments. And of course, you also try and encourage people not to go for the other side of the curve, which is high reward, no risk, and then you have to try and explain to them that's definitely a scam. those don't really exist. But now I think what we've been doing for the last year and a half at Rand Swiss is we've really been creating a wealth manager to complement our securities business. So we've done a lot of work around this, and it's an absolutely fascinating segment of the market, because it doesn't just look at the underlying composition of investments. It looks at the people that are investing them, and are you saving for a child's education? Are you saving to buy your first house? Do you have a long time horizon? Do you have a short time horizon? What are your concerns about the market, for example? So many concerns that we hear these days are, I'm terrified of the future of South Africa. I'm terrified of the political risks, and those are often overblown. And you kind of have to sit with the clients and really understand, but what are you afraid of here? Are you afraid of market risk? Are you afraid of the South African market underperforming international markets? Are you afraid of a Cyprus type situation where money is being seized from bank accounts? Are you afraid of systemic risk? What are you actually afraid of here? And how legitimate are those fears given the current environment? And often you find there's a lot of irrational fear as well. And I think you need to address that first. So that for me is always the first point when trying to make an investment decision.
Do people understand how it works? Do they understand the markets? Because they watch movies like Wall Street and they think, it's buy and sell and I'll be rich quickly. But it's not. It's the long game.
I think, and it's a great point, because it really, that is, I think, there's a movie out there called The Big Short. It's got a wonderful, it's a Mark Twain quote as it starts. Yes. It's not what you don't know that'll get you. It's what you know for sure, but just ain't so. And there's a lot of I think there's a lot of assumptions that people make when coming into investments. As you say, they watch the movies, they think, oh, well, I understand this, it's buying and selling, it's whatever. And they come in with these preconceptions that are just plain wrong. And mm-hmm. and it's difficult to almost convince them that you've actually got to come in with an open mind and understand that there's probably a lot that you don't know about investments.
No, exactly. All right, but you can take that risk and you can probably make some money, I suppose, but you also have those slow burners. I'm thinking about the Satrix 20 or Satrix 40, where your money sits there and you make some money. That's safe, isn't it?
It's interesting. So you see, these are the preconceptions I'm talking about. So the slow burner. So if I looked at typically, like if you look at one way of kind of assessing a client and trying to mitigate some of the risks, one of the key things that you talk about with a client is asset allocation. So how, you know, and if you look at the typical asset classes, you know, property is interesting because it kind of sometimes gets lumped in with bonds, sometimes it gets stripped out. But you'd have your stock portfolio, your bond portfolio, your property portfolio, your cash or money market instruments, and your alternative, which is your wine collection, your baseball cards, maybe a bit of crypto, you know, whatever you have in your alternative bucket. But you know, you talk about Satrix 40. That typically is not a slow burner. It shouldn't be a slow burner. That's actually that is in your equity basket. That would typically be considered a high risk investment if you're looking at risk as volatility. So, yeah, I'd say absolutely. You've got them. They're long term investments. I mean, I suppose maybe slow burner in terms of long term. I can understand, but that's an equity investment. So yes, it's something that if you have a long term time horizon and you want to capture historically what has given you the best growth, this is a segment of the market you almost have to be playing in, because another risk that I think a lot of people don't appreciate is that inflation risk. That if you don't beat inflation. And you're sitting in a bank account going, oh, well, my money's at low risk, but I'm getting this great 8 or 9% interest rate. And then you kind of realize that, one, you're going to pay income tax on that. So if you're in a higher income tax bracket, you know, a good chunk of that is gone. And now you're kind of getting in line with inflation. Your money's not actually growing. It might be growing in nominal terms. Your bank account might be getting bigger, but your spending power is being eroded. So lots of risk that you got to consider. And yeah, I think Satrix 40, an interesting one. A lot of guys are going overseas these days, so they're looking at the US equivalent of this, which is an S&P 500, something Vanguard trackers. But there, you know, if you buy them through the local markets, for example, you end up paying tax on your principal's currency depreciation. So there's lots of these nuances that I think investors need to be aware of.
And also, speaking about currencies, and all of a sudden there are those things in the news that make currencies like the Rand dip up and dip down, and then confidence in markets. You have all these external factors. Gary, these are a slight problem, aren't they? They really can affect what you're trying to do, trying to build money.
Absolutely. So currency risk is a massive factor, and I think it's becoming more and more prevalent. And I mean, I think we've got a client situation now where there's this belief that there's no future in South Africa, but they still want to live in South Africa. and you kind of, and to the extent where everything is, like, to the last penny is overseas, and everything locally is leveraged, and everything is overseas. And you kind of have to sit and really outline the risk to the client, saying, you understand that, you know, the currency, I mean, historically, the Rand has weakened against the US dollar by about 6% on average per year. And it is fairly predictable because you have the inflation differentials between the two economies. So you would expect that to continue. But you go through these periods where you get these big currency weakenings, but then you also get these periods of big currency strengthening. And now suddenly, if all your expenses are local and you're actually drawing down on these international investments to fund your local lifestyle, and suddenly you go through a period where the Rand gets a lot stronger, which does happen historically, you can be very wrong-footed. So you need to take that into consideration as well. So a lot of different factors.
Yeah, because people do that. But also there's the tax man. Don't you also have to take the tax man into account? Because a lot of people don't realize this. They emigrate or they go hide money offshore. They make money elsewhere. And I was chatting to the SARS Commissioner, Edward Kiswetta, recently in an interview. And he just said, Ray, I know exactly where your money is and what you're doing. To which I stared at him and he said, I'm just joking, but what I'm trying to say is we know where everybody's money is. And they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's an important consideration. So you know, tax planning. And I mean, there's evasion and there's avoidance. and really, there's nothing wrong with taking a view and trying to structure your affairs in a way that is as efficient as possible. As an investor, you essentially have three taxes that you need to be cognizant of. So obviously, your income tax, which is going to be on bank deposits or accumulating income funds, that's going to add to your income and your income tax payment. You know, there's ways of mitigating that by contributing to a retirement annuity, for example. So you can deduct that off your income. But that's the first tax. The second tax is obviously dividend withholding tax. You run a company, you pay your company tax, but you've got to distribute it. You're going to pay 20% on your dividends. I mean, that's generally done, you know, if you're holding a share, you don't even consider the dividend withholding tax, but it's there, it's being paid. And then of course, you've got the capital gains tax as well. So lots of taxes for investors to bear in mind. I suppose the concept of hiding money offshore these days, it's not as simple as potentially it was historically, because yeah, as you say, you know, I think banking secrecy is gone. I mean, what we've seen with the common reporting standards, and certainly I think with the grey listing of South Africa now as well, you've got an incredible focus being put on understanding who the ultimate beneficial owner of any asset is. Mm. You can go and structure a trust out of Guernsey or British Virgin Islands or Mauritius, but if you want an account in South Africa, or even if you want an account at a European bank, for example, they are going to want to know exactly who are the trustees, who they want to get to the warm bodies on all of these things. So, you know, these kind of numbered bank accounts that people imagine from the movies, they don't exist anymore.
Interesting. Okay. All right. Let's go back to investing then. If you want a higher return, if you want to make some money, what do you have to do? A difficult question. It's a difficult one because everybody's listening to Ray asked the question. How do you make money then?
It's wonderful. So I had a former employee come to our office. He's moved on. He's working at a very prestigious international wealth firm. And the first thing he said, oh, I'm so sick of these clients asking me how to make them money. Don't they realize that I'm here to preserve their money? It's their job to make the money. They must go out and start businesses and make money. Give it to me. I'll make sure it grows ahead of inflation. But how do you make... So the question is, how do you make money in the markets?
Yes, there we go.
How do you make money in the markets? Time. Time is the answer. Right. So it really is time in the markets. So, you know, there's all the, you know, the nuances of selecting the right investment and going in there. And, you know, there's a huge amount of work. And I mean, we can talk about that for hours. And I can take you through a million different ways of analyzing stocks and analyzing companies and, you know, looking at the different investment options. But really, you know, for the listeners out there, it's such a simple concept. It comes down to compounding and time. Yeah. And the sooner you start, the more you can put away, the quicker you can put it away, the more you're going to have in the end. You know, when you're borrowing to finance consumption, so if you're going out and spending on your credit card or, you know, getting personal loans because you want a fancy new TV or that, all you're doing is essentially borrowing from your future self. You've got to pay that back at some point. You've got to then go and do all the work to make the money to pay for those items. If you can contract your consumption and you can put additional money away, wonderful things happen, because if you put it into the market, you put it into something like an S&P 500 or a Satrix 40, generally that grows ahead of inflation. So what you do is your money becomes more money in after inflation terms. And like you say, I think Warren Buffett said, you know, Warren Buffett regretted that he started saving too late. And I think he started when he was 11 years old. But it kind of comes down to the old, you know, when's the best time to plant a tree, you know, 20 years ago. But the second best time is today. So the sooner you start, the sooner it will grow.
Invest. We're chatting to Gary Boyson, who's a director at Rand Swiss. He's our headmaster in our investment school tonight. Talking about banks, you know, what is your view? They do offer some good packages. If you want money to go and sit there, you can grow something. Your view?
You're just bank deposits?
Yeah, a bank deposit, a fixed term. Let me go. You have to invest more than 50,000 rand. You can take it out if you really want to, or you can keep it for a couple of years, or, you know, they've got these time constraints.
Sure. I think it comes down to, again, your personal situation. So generally, if you're going to need that money, you know, shorter term, a bank deposit is a great place to park cash. If you have a very strong view that markets have run too hard, cash is a great parking spot, and there are wonderful bank products to use. As I said earlier, the problem with bank deposits is specifically, especially in South Africa, if you're not using essentially an accumulating money market fund internationally, if you're using like a distributing income fund or you're just using a bank deposit, all of that's going to be added to your income tax line. So, you know, you might look at it and go, 9%, I put 100 grand away, you know, at the end of the year, I've got 109,000. The problem is, you know, if you're above the interest exemption, let's assume that as well, you're going to pay tax on that. And then your return is, your after-tax return is actually not that great. And you're kind of just matching inflation. And if you can put the money away longer term, you really should. You shouldn't be in cash. Your money market exposure should essentially, or your cash exposure, the way that we think about it, that really is your emergency fund. It's your, or it's an emergency fund, or it's the frictional balance that you have while you're deploying into more reasonable growth assets. So, you know, if you, you know, and you kind of take it, I mean, there's all sorts of different rules of thumb that you can use, but, you know, you typically might need, say, 3 to 6 months worth of expenses sitting in cash. And there's different reasons, you know, when you run a financial services provider that has a Cat 2 license, you need to have 8 weeks expenses in your bank account in cash pretty much all the time. So,
ouch,
I look at that and go, oh, the dead money.
I could do so much with that.
but I think cash is really, like I said, a parking spot. It's a solution for a short-term requirement.
Yeah. All right, so taking a closer look at this, and it is a bit of a problem. Sometimes you want to put your money in, you've got to wait a long time for it to, but is it always a long time? I mean, obviously shares go up and shares go down, equities do, they bounce up and bounce down.
No, absolutely, and I suppose if you had bought into the whole AI theme about a year ago,
here we go.
There's no short term about that. You know, we're looking at some pretty spectacular returns.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that comes down to a concept we often discuss with clients around barbell investing as well. So the kind of the money that you want to be, the slow burners, if you want to put it that way, or the more stable money, that should be your bread and butter money. That's the kind of money that you're putting away. It's going to, like I said, that's going to fund you. You know, you lose a job, or you know, you can't work for whatever reason. That's going to get you through that period. But then you've got the bar. But then you've got the end of the bar, the barbell as well, like the two sides where you can start to take like some interesting risk. And there, that's where the alternative segment does come in a big way. And the guys that bought Bitcoin down back at
I was about to say the crypto word, and I thought I'm going to just mess with him here.
It's true. It's, you know, like I still look at crypto. You can't value it fundamentally. The argument around the value for crypto is based on scarcity. And you kind of say, yes, there might be however many 21 billion Bitcoins available and a lot have disappeared. But is that real scarcity? It's scarcity in Bitcoin, but you can seem to create as many coins as you want. Is there really scarcity in crypto if you can create a million copies of this? So I'm still wrapping my head around crypto. I think, you know, the crypto run that we've seen now has been absolutely spectacular. And the pullback that we saw, everyone was like, oh, crypto's dead, this is the end. And suddenly we've had this resurgence. And I think a lot of that is the legitimization of crypto assets. We've also just done our licensing for crypto as well. We're one of the few firms that were approved for, you know, have crypto on our license so we can advise on it. We're still trying to work out how you advise on this.
It's difficult.
I mean, you can look at it from a technical basis, literally go look at some charts and try and draw some lines.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen arguments to be made that you can actually value the underlying, you can put an underpin on crypto based on the price of electricity and how much it costs to mine one new, like a marginal Bitcoin. So there's all these theories on how you could potentially price it fundamentally as well, but at this stage it is almost impossible to price, so it is quite difficult to advise on at this stage.
It's a roller coaster ride, let's be honest.
But I think, you know, with the regulation and with the rise of the crypto ETFs, you're seeing a lot of big institutions starting to use the asset class. For example, one of our Swiss bank partners was the first European bank to actually be able to house the actual crypto tokens, and now will accept Bitcoin or Ethereum deposits into the bank, which is just incredible.
Yeah.
You can actually take it out of your hard wallet or off your Luno account or wherever you've got it, and you can put it into a Swiss bank regulated by FINMA. I mean, really cool
stuff.
That's
a whole new world, whole new step actually. Yeah. Yeah.
So, and I think that legitimization is certainly fueling some of the excitement that we're seeing around the crypto at the moment.
Here's a question. We all have our smartphones. We all have our apps. I know I have one where I go and have a look at equity once in a while. Is it easy to trade on your own, or do you need a broker?
That's very easy to trade on your own. It's very easy to perform the action of trading on your own.
You can
buy and sell yourself with no problems whatsoever.
Is it easy to make money on your own? Let me rephrase my question.
That is a totally different question. So that's what I say. I mean, we're busy training new dealers at the moment, and you sit with them and they're kind of looking at, you put up all the screens and they look at it and they go, oh, this is so complicated. You're like, actually, it's not. You'll probably know everything you need to know about what is a limit order, what is a market order, you know, how does the depth work, how do you actually buy and sell a security. You can learn all of that in 2 to 3 months. You should have it pretty much waxed. And it'll take you a life, and more than a lifetime, to understand all the nuances of how pricing moves and why it moves and why different instruments behave in their own way. So, you can look at the stats on the big online platforms. A lot of the ones that are regulated out of Europe have to publish what their win rate is. And it's generally 76% of customers lose money, especially when trading kind of more exotic instruments. But I would recommend, work with a financial advisor, work with someone that knows the market. So, like I said, when we spoke earlier, it's really about first knowing yourself, but the best benefit then is to have someone else that also knows you, but that person who knows all the underlying instruments. If you can find the person that knows you and knows the instrument and is the bridge, it'll be far, far better for you. The problem is, it's not as easy to do as it seems.
That person looks like Gary Boyson, who's a director at Rand Swiss. Gary, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I do appreciate you taking the time to come chat with us live at The Money Show. Thank you.
Thanks, man.